You are listening to the eWatchman Podcast with your host, Robert King.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. You're listening to the Watchman's Post. This program was recorded for, let's call it the third week of November. Hopefully, by the time you listen to this, I will have acquired home internet service. It's been an agonizing ordeal, but I'm not going to dwell on it now. I only have one question for this week's program, but or one emailer. He has a number of questions in here, so I thought I'd talk about that. I might run out of wind at about 10 or 15 minutes, or I might not. I don't know. I do want to offer this caveat, or disclaimer, I should say. You know, I don't read from notes or an outline or anything like that. I just speak extemporaneously. Some questions, I obviously do research before I open my mouth. Others, if I feel like I know the subject well, I sort of shoot from the hip. But I realize at times I make misstatements, you know, as I have to go back and listen to the programs. And, you know, when you're speaking extemporaneously, it has a few perils. And while your mouth is moving, you are not always fully engaged in monitoring what's coming out of your mouth because you're thinking ahead, maybe what you're going to say next, trying to formulate your thoughts, or maybe looking at the computer screen, monitoring something on that. And so you don't really fully, you can't catch every misstatement. So I do want to put that out there. I realize I have made several misstatements over the years I've been doing these programs, and I think most listeners realize when they hear a misstatement that it was one of those, you know, just brain glitches and wasn't something that I intended to say. So having said that, it's embarrassing enough to make a misstatement, but we all do, don't we? Okay. The emailer says, before I get to my question, I would like to say I really enjoy listening to your podcast and watching your videos. Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoy it. I'm glad there are a few people out there watching and listening. He goes on to say, my question is this. I was raised as one of Jehovah's Witnesses for the better part of my childhood, and I was taught that Noah's flood occurred approximately 1,000 years after Adam and Eve were created. That's true. Well, actually, it's 1,500 years. But so that would be approximately 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, depending on how you add up the chronology of the Bible. And then his question is, how could this be? Am I to believe that every animal on planet Earth has repopulated? Obviously, there are many thousands and thousands more species of animals than could fit on the ark. And then he says, explain the meteor crater in northern Arizona. Obviously, that impact site is around 35,000 years old, but it shows no signs of being submerged underwater. And then he says, I have a secondary question, but I'll save that one. Okay, am I to believe that every animal on planet Earth is repopulated? Well, yes. I don't see that there should be a problem with that. Animals can be quite prolific, depending upon the kind or the species, if you prefer. There's a vivid example in history of this. If you recall, when the British started colonizing Australia, somebody thought it would be a good idea to take along a couple of rabbits and introduce them to this island continent, and perhaps for game, you know? Well, it turned out there were no natural predators of rabbits on the island. And so in a very few years, a couple of decades, I believe, the island was completely overrun with rabbits. And they had to introduce the dingo, a wild dog, to to take care of the rabbit problem. Of course, rabbits are known for their fertility. That's an extreme example. But given thousands of years, yes, animals can reproduce in the thousands and millions. Take the example of our own kind, humankind, mankind. There are about 7 billion people on the planet now. By the turn of the 20th century, there were just 1 billion. So in 110 years since then, the population has increased sevenfold. I used to have a Bible study with a gentleman back in the early 80s, and he was a mathematician. In fact, he worked for the U.S. government, and he told me that he was part of the team that came up with the whole zip code arrangement for the United States. Depending on how old you are, you might take it for granted, but back, I think before the 60s, there wasn't any such thing as a zip code. You just put the street number, the city, and that was that. Of course, in the UK, they call it a postal code, but anyway, he came up with that system. So I wanted to engage him in this question because he couldn't believe that mankind had only been on the earth for a few thousand years. So I asked him, I said, could you come up with a way to determine, if you had a number of reference points for population growth, could you extrapolate backwards and arrive at approximate year when the whole thing started with two people? And he was intrigued by that. And he said, yes, I could do that. And so I got some figures for him. I can't remember what they are now, but we looked it up in the encyclopedia. And I left him with that and came back in a week or two for our next little get-together. And he had worked out a number, and it was very close to 4,000 or 5,000 years ago for the beginning of it all. Of course, Adam and Eve started off an entire world. That world perished, and Noah and his wife and sons and their wives, they started afresh. So we're all related to Adam and Eve, and we're all related to Noah and his wife. And so are all the animals related to those animals that were taken on the ark. He said, am I to believe that every animal on earth is repopulated? He says, obviously, there are many thousands and thousands more species of animals than could fit on the ark. Well, that's simply not true. For one thing, you may not, I don't know if you understand what the word species is that you're using. Take, for example, a dog, a collie. That's a species of dog. The German Shepherd is another species, right? But all of these species of dogs can come from the same genetic pool, the same kind. Going back to Genesis 1, the first chapter, Jehovah said, you know, he created them according to their kinds. So there's the dog kind, there's the cat kind, there's the bovine kind, there's the horse kind, and so on and so on. But within each of those kinds, there is tremendous potential for diversity. But you can't change from one kind to the other. Jehovah established certain immutable boundaries. But within each kind, like I say, you can have tremendous variety. So all the dogs that we see today, including the dingo, maybe the coyote, wolf, all the canines came from two dogs. That's how it worked. Look at, again, our kind, humankind. All the people on this planet, from the Oriental, the African, the European, the Eskimos, you know, there's tremendous variety of humankind. There's, you know, the eight-footers, and then there's a four-foot pygmy. All of mankind came from two. And that's not taken on faith. Science has proved this. Whether they choose to call her Mother Eve, no. But those who have studied genetics recognize and accept as a scientific fact that all of humankind came from an original mother. Call her Eve if you want. That's what the Bible calls her. But so again, it shows the tremendous variety that Jehovah designed into each kind. So there are not that many kinds. And as a matter of fact, there are not that many large kinds of animals. The number of large animals is a very small percentage, you know, in relation to all the animals on Earth. The giraffe, the elephant, and big polar bears and grizzly bears. Maybe there's a few hundred species, you know, cows and water buffalo and wildebeest and so on. But most animals are very small, you know, little rodents and rabbits and birds. And you know, who's to say? When Jehovah brought the animals to Noah, and that's the way the account reads, Noah didn't have to go out and do a roundup. Jehovah brought the animals to him, just as he brought them to Adam for him to name. He brought the animals to Noah in pairs. Who's to say that Jehovah did not bring juvenile animals? Would he have had to bring, you know, this massive African elephant or, you know, a giraffe at 10 or 12 feet tall? Could he have brought a couple of giraffes that were juvenile, maybe a year or two old, that were not full grown? Why not? So also, you know, it's possible that Jehovah could have put quite a number of animals into a hibernative sleep. Now, we know that like polar bears go to sleep for months. But many other animals have the capacity to go into a hibernative sleep. Whether they do or not, that's a different question, but they have the capacity to do that. Maybe Jehovah did something like that to reduce the food supply that would be needed to feed animals for a year. We don't know, and the Bible account is very brief. But don't forget the size of the ark. It's been said it was 450 feet long. So that's like 1.5 football fields, American-sized football fields. Plus, it was 3 stories. It's been said that the Ark had the carrying capacity of a freight train with 250 freight cars, American-sized freight cars. They're a little bigger than the European freight cars. So that's a tremendous amount of space. Now, the question here, he says, explain the meteor crater in northern Arizona. He says, obviously, the impact site is around 35,000 years old, but it shows no signs of being submerged underwater. I did some research on this, and the several references I've read said that scientists estimated that it was 50,000 years old. Well, is it possible that they could be wrong? I couldn't find any information on the dating methods that they used. So, but we do know from experience that oftentimes dating can be dating can be very tricky, and oftentimes inaccurate. It's interesting that not too far from this. Oh, by the way, in doing research on this crater in Arizona, it's called the Beringer Crater, named after a fellow that actually bought the land, acres around this crater. Mr. Beringer, around the 1900s, he had a successful mining company. And at the time, not too many people thought that this big hole in the ground was caused by a meteor. The accepted idea was that it was a volcanic crater. But Mr. Beringer recognized it as a meteor crater. And being a miner, he knew that meteors were made of iron and nickel. He thought he was going to find the mother lode. He thought it would be worth billions of dollars, a huge hunk of iron. And he bought the land. The government sold it to him, Theodore Roosevelt. And he actually went down into the crater and dug down hundreds of feet looking for the meteor. And of course, he never found it. He didn't realize that when this thing was flying at 25,000 miles an hour, and it smacked into the Earth. It completely disintegrated, burned up, melted, fused with other rocks. They've only found a few fragments of iron from this massive meteor that struck the Earth. Anyway, the Barringer family actually still owns the property around this crater. It hasn't become a national monument, I don't think. I've driven by there a few times. I regret that I didn't. It's several miles off the main freeway, and I think that a few times I've driven by there, I was in a hurry to get somewhere, probably. Anyway, it is interesting that not too far from the Barringer crater is a vast monument to the flood of Noah's day. And of course, I'm referring to the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon is 10 miles across. I have been there a number of times. And if you ever have the opportunity, you should go there because it is a jaw dropper. You know, looking at the photographs of the canyon doesn't do it. You have to stand next to it, I think, and look down in that canyon. So it's 10 miles across, and some places actually 20 miles across and a mile deep. And the conventional thinking is that this tiny little river, which is this, you can barely see it at the bottom, and when you're standing up on the rim, this tiny little river over millions and millions of years cut through. But that makes no sense. I mean, the river would have to be 10 miles wide. What river is 10 miles wide? If it were 10 miles wide, the water would be what, a half an inch deep? I think people fail to appreciate the scope of the deluge. We've seen pictures and newsreels of local flooding, and they can be quite catastrophic. But we're talking about something on a whole other level. An ocean of waters was suspended above the earth. And not only that, the scripture says that Jehovah unleashed all the watery deep, all the springs of the watery deep, tremendous geysers, and no doubt volcanic eruptions underwater. And so massive amounts of earth were moved. And when water is very turbulent, imagine one day a mass of earth comes from one direction, and it is a particular sediment. And then another upheaval, the water surges the other way, and it's carrying a different kind of sediment. So layer upon layer, a layer of silt is laid down, which scientists now examining this, for example, the geologic layout of the Grand Canyon, they have this, what they call the uniformitarian mindset. And they think that the way things are now is the way things have always been, that there haven't been great catastrophes. Although many scientists are coming around to the view that, yes, catastrophism explains the geologic formations much better than this notion that things just inch along over millions and millions of years. So all these various sediment layers are laid down. And we know that the crust of the earth, this firma terra that we stand on, is actually floating on a sea of molten lava. And imagine now the unimaginable forces of water weighing down on the earth. And it presses down, and some parts of the earth are suppressed. The Bible says, Jehovah said he went causing mountains to ascend and valleys to descend. So we have a place on the earth, the Mariana Trench. It's 6 miles deep. So with all that water rushing into a trench, the mantle gets put. It's like a waterbed. You push on a waterbed, it goes, depresses in one place, but it raises up in another. So the interior of the United States, where the Grand Canyon is 1 mile above sea level. Now imagine this whole area rising up with the weight of the water pushing down in other areas. So now the water is being raised above, the land is raised above sea level. So the water goes rushing towards the lowest point. and it tries to find a way through, and that's how the canyon was formed. The sediment layers were very soft. They'd just been laid down, and this ocean of water in the interior of the United States went rushing out to the Pacific Ocean. Happened in a very short period of time, months. We know that the Earth at one time had a uniform climate, semi-tropical climate. Scientists know that. That is unexplainable according to the weather patterns we experience now. The Earth being tilted 23.5 degrees, there are always going to be seasons. There are always going to be extremes, winter, summer. But it wasn't always that way. They know that in the northern climes, in Alaska and Siberia, it used to be semi-tropical. And it had non-Arctic animals. There are millions of animals frozen in the ice in Siberia. I knew a fellow personally who worked in the Prudhoe Bay oil fields in Alaska. And he said that when they would sink their drilling bits into the earth, that on occasion they would get palm fronds wrapped around them as they went down into the permafrost. So at one time there were palm trees growing now where nothing will grow. It's so cold. So what happened? Well, only the Bible explains it. And we go back to the Genesis. Day two of creation, Jehovah said, let there occur a division between the waters. So Jehovah, by his almighty power, suspended an ocean above the earth with the atmospheric expanse in between. The Hebrew word for heavenly ocean is deluge. And we shouldn't think of it as water vapor. The Bible doesn't say it was vapor, such as we're familiar with cloud vapor. It was water, perhaps up in the thermosphere. And that by that means, Jehovah caused this great flood. But imagine now, the earth would have been like a greenhouse. We hear, you know, the greenhouse effect. Well, with this watery blanket around the earth, it would hold in the heat. Probably the weather was much different. The atmospheric conditions were different. There may have been more air pressure, greater existence of oxygen, and that's why some animals, fossil records show that some animals were huge. Like there are species of horse that are much bigger than the horses we have now. Gigantic beavers, huge plants. Anyway, when this water canopy came crashing down over a period of 40 days, it would be like throwing a rock through a greenhouse glass on a cold winter's day, and the heat would rapidly dissipate on the poles. And the flood apparently began in November 1st, so it would have been winter in the northern hemisphere. That's why they have found these woolly mammoths frozen in the ice with green grass in their mouth and undigested grass in their stomachs. They were quick frozen. Some scientists say, well, no, that's not what happened. They stepped into a big, you know, pot of tar, and they were entombed that way, which is ridiculous. Because if a warm-blooded animal goes into a tar pit, their body will decompose because of the heat within their body and the bacteria and so forth. There would be nothing left. The only way to preserve an animal, some of these woolly mammoths that they've discovered, their flesh is edible. In fact, wolves feed on them if they find one that's been uncovered in the tundra. By the way, this global warming thing has been a trend ever since the flood. The Earth back then, when it was subjected to this extreme climate change and massive amounts of water were frozen in ice, but gradually, ever since then, the Earth is gradually warming more and more. And perhaps it's been accelerated in the last 100 years due to industrial activity, but the entire trend from what they call the last ice age has been a warming trend. And incidentally, that explains how some animals, for example, the koala bear and the kangaroo, came to exist on Australia and nowhere else. Because at one time, there were such a massive amounts of water locked up in ice that the sea levels were lower and the islands were connected. They know that, you know, England was once connected with Europe, Cuba was connected with Florida, Australia was connected with Asia through Indonesia, and so forth and so on. But due to this gradual warming trend, more and more ice is melting, raising the sea level. They know that to be the case. For example, like the Hudson River, you can follow its channel under the Atlantic Ocean. There's a channel that goes out several hundred miles or 100 some miles out into the Atlantic, showing that the water levels were much lower not that long ago. So as these, as the water level rose, then these sea bridges, land bridges, I should say, were submerged. And perhaps there were kangaroo and koala bears elsewhere, but they perished. They became extinct elsewhere because of predators. And that explains that phenomenon. Some people think, well, no, they evolved independently on Australia, in Australia. That's, of course, ridiculous. There's no evidence of any creature ever evolving from anything. That's just, it's a nonsensical myth. Going back to Arizona, there's another phenomena not far from the Grand Canyon and this Beringer Crater, another phenomenon that gives evidence of the flood, and that is the petrified forest. What is a petrified forest? Well, it's trees that have turned to rock. It's basically a fossilized tree. Now, it's very rare because it has to have a certain condition for that to come about. As you know, if a tree falls in the forest, whether you hear it or not, it's a different story, but it rots. A mighty oak tree, in 10 years, it's going to be pretty much nothing left, right? And the fungus, the insects, the weather, the rain, it breaks everything down. But here we have these fossilized trees. What has to happen with any fossil is the creature, the plant or the animal, has to be fairly quickly covered with mud. And in the case of a petrified tree, the minerals of the sediment leach into the tree. And over time, the wood eventually disintegrates, but the minerals have been impregnated into the tissue of the tree, if you will. And then it solidifies, the sediment solidifies, so you have a rock that's taken the shape of a tree, and it is a rock. So this can only take place under conditions of a flood. Fossils are not normally formed. I mean, if an animal dies, its carcass is going to be devoured by a scavenger or a predator of some sort, or just dissolved. And we've all seen some animal on the side of the road, and if you travel the same path frequently, you'll notice day by day that there's less and less left of it. So, but there's millions and millions of fossils that have been discovered. They come about from this global flood. So anyway, it's interesting, though, that the questioner here said that there's no evidence of this Beringer Crater having been submerged. So is it out of the question that this meteor could have struck the Earth after the flood? I see no reason to think that couldn't be the case. I did come across an interesting little factoid in researching this. The Hopi Indians, who live in the desert southwest, they have a legend, no doubt told generation after generation around the campfires. They have a legend of this fire that fell from the sky, and referring to this Beringer meteor. They saw it, apparently, or heard it, and then saw the results of it gouged into the earth. So, but the Hopi Indians weren't around 50,000 years ago or even 35,000 years ago. So he says, I have a secondary question. I was extremely pro-creation and supported the Bible until I researched on my own how the New Testament was put together. Aren't you a little skeptical on how this was done? Well, no, I'm not really skeptical. I appreciate that there are a lot of challenges to the Bible being what it is, to being preserved. When you think about it, it's really nothing short of miraculous. When you consider that the Bible was written over 1,600 years, and it was written on highly perishable materials, animal skins and papyrus. And not only that, the so-called Old Testament, the Jews were constantly, you know, having wars and internal struggles and strife and apostasy. And then, you know, the big crash when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem. And yet the scriptures survived that somehow. We don't know how. And not only that, we consider the prophets. The prophets spoke against the Jewish establishment, against the kings and the priests. What interest would those enemies of Jehovah have in preserving the writings of these men who denounced them? And yet that is exactly what happened. So, yeah, and so when it comes to the so-called New Testament, there were probably many more letters written by Paul and Peter than what we have. But I think you have to credit Jehovah. He is the overall author who inspired all of those men, going back to Moses. Actually, when you consider, Jehovah contributed the first part of the Bible with his own writing. When you consider that nothing had been written, if you consider the book of Enoch, but nothing had really been written of the Bible we have now until Jehovah wrote the Ten Commandments with his own finger, the Bible says, etched it into stone. And that's Moses took it from there. But anyway, obviously, Jehovah has a vested interest in preserving his word. And he is almighty. And so that is evidenced by the very fact that the Bible has been preserved through all of these obstacles and challenges. And the fact that after the Catholic Church came in control, they tried to keep the Bible locked in a dead language in Latin. They viciously persecuted anyone who tried to translate the Bible into the vernacular. They burned Bibles by the thousands, apparently. And yet, the Bible is the most widely read and distributed book in the world now. Now, I know there are questions about what books deserve to be in the Bible, but according to what I've researched on this, the first century Christians pretty much accepted everything that we have as our canon now. In the year 405 is when, the first translation of the Bible took place, other than the Septuagint. But that was when Jerome translated both the Old and New Testament into Latin. And according to Jerome, he accepted exactly the same books and letters that we accept as he called it the Divine Library. He coined that term. So whether a person was a worshiper of Jehovah, it doesn't matter. But those who had charge of the scriptures, Jehovah made sure that what was put in was what he wanted in, what was left out was what he wanted left out. I mean, some years later, the Catholic Church inserted the apocryphal writings, but they pretty much are their own, best evidence for them not being in the Bible. They're ridiculous. If you've ever read the apocryphal, it has no place in the Bible. But of course, the Vatican is really no friend of the Bible, or they weren't. So, but Jesus made a comment one time. He said that wisdom is proved righteous by its works. So the purpose of the scriptures is to produce a people that are true to God. And I think it's done that with Jehovah's Witnesses. Of course, we've got to go through this test, right? Jesus asked the searching question. He said, "Nevertheless, when the Son of Man arrives, will he really find the faith on the earth?" Maybe not in everyone, but he will in some. We can be sure of that. So the Bible will be instrumental in producing that faith that will be able to stand up during this time of terror and Holocaust called the Great Tribulation. And that is the true test of the endurance of the Word of God and its power to create a people of faith. Okay, well, I guess that'll do it for this week. Thank you so much for your question. I enjoyed doing a little research on that Barringer meteor. It was very interesting. I hadn't realized that how many meteors have actually struck the Earth. Apparently, it's quite a few. As many as have hit the moon or more, because we're a bigger target than the moon. When we look up at the moon, it's just, you know, pockmarked all over. But there are a number of meteor craters. They keep finding them because of satellite imagery. But most of them have been severely eroded, or they're filled with water. They become lakes, or they're covered in vegetation. That's the thing that makes this Barringer crater unique in some ways, because it's out in the arid desert southwest. There's nothing that grows there to hasten erosion. It rains very little. I'm sure it suffers from wind erosion, but okay, well, if you have any questions, send them my way. Even if you maybe necessarily don't have a question, but you would like me to talk on a particular topic, you know, let me know. I need a little input and get my juices flowing, you know. Thank you for listening. Hope to talk to you again soon, and may Jehovah bless your search for the truth.